Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us in this latest episode of Chaser Takeaway video series, where we feature a leading expert in a particular issue or a country of concern for British defense. Obviously, these are conversations between two academics and experts that does not reflect any views of the British Army or Ministry of Defense. And today we want to discuss Turkey. It matters a lot for the United Kingdom. You might have seen the news that it's currently sending PPE kits to the UK, which is very welcome. But there is a lot of good bilateral relationship that has been building on for the last 5-6 years in economy and trade terms, as well as counterterrorism, and a lot of similar foreign policy perspectives on question of Syria, on question of Black Sea and the Balkans and Russian expansion in Crimea and stability in Libya and North Africa. UK and Turkey find each other aligned on a lot of questions, perfect even on the question of European Union, two countries on the edges of it, one leaving, one wants to get in, perhaps not successfully. So even the European Union conversation has implications for both of them. And today we are thrilled to have a leading observer and analyst of Turkey, a trained historian based in Washington, D.C., Soner Çağatay, who's the author of multiple books on President Erdogan as well as Turkey, and he's frequently interviewed by international media. And we want to discuss with him key questions of importance for us in understanding Turkish foreign policy, its current portfolio, and its direction. Soner, let's jump in. First one of these, obviously, which is very important, and that's the topic of your last book, that's Turkish foreign policy towards the Middle East. It's a major actor. It has huge impact on what's happening on a lot of key countries for us in Iraq and Syria and etc. How do you conceptualize Turkish foreign policy towards Middle East, its priorities, its activities, and its direction?
First of all, thank you, Ziya, for hosting me on your podcast. I'm very pleased to be here. Turkey is indeed a very important country, whether it's for the United States or the United Kingdom. In fact, it's a very important country for all NATO members. That's because of Turkey's location. Turkey borders Iran, Iraq, Syria, Russia across the Black Sea, and formerly ISIS-held territories. So whatever the strategic concerns, security concerns, or policies are of NATO members, UK, US, and others, towards these five countries and entities, they're much easier with Turkey on board. Those policies are still implementable without Turkey, but they become costly, cumbersome, and difficult. So I think Turkey can be a facilitator or a spoiler. Therefore, it's really important to understand what it is doing towards the Middle East, its three neighbors, Iran, Iraq, Syria, but also the broader region, as well as towards Russia. I think that Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is one of the most consequential leaders globally, as well as consequential in terms of Turkish domestic politics. He's someone who has, for the most part, changed Turkey's 20th century political culture. He's political Islamist. He decided that he would carve a role out for Turkey among Muslim majority nations and the Middle East. It looked like this policy was working for him. I believe that Erdogan has a bright side. He delivered quite phenomenal economic growth until recently. As a result of that, he's built a base of adoring supporters. And Erdogan used that economic growth that unfortunately went away with the 2018 crisis in Turkey when the country's economy went into recession. But for nearly 15 years, from 2003 to 2018, he delivered quite phenomenal growth. He used that growth to make Turkey a star power nation, and he thought that by supporting at the beginning of the Arab uprisings, by supporting Muslim Brotherhood related parties, he could make Turkey a star power nation in the Middle East. It hasn't quite turned out that way. I think Erdogan tried really hard. That's because in Syria, Turkey ran into its historic nemesis, Russia, and historic competitor, Iran, against which it was soon left almost alone, with President Obama backing away from his earlier commitment to oust the Assad regime. And I think maybe that was an ill-conceived step on behalf of Erdogan to not recalibrate Turkish policy when he realized that the United States was not going to push hard against Assad. Starting in 2013, it was a dramatic change of US policy, at which time, following his famous Rose Garden walk, Obama decided that even though Assad had used chemical weapons and violated his red line, he was not going to push back. So that left Turkey alone. At this stage, I think Turkey ought to have calibrated its policy. It did not. So suddenly there it is, fighting a war to oust Assad regime, which is backed by two most important countries for Turkish policy in the Middle East, Russia and Iran. So that's, I think, not a very good net gain for Turkey and Syria. On top of it, I think Erdogan's policy of supporting brotherhood-related parties left Turkey even further isolated, far away from Erdogan's goal, who thought he could make Turkey a leader country in the Middle East. Here's how it went. I think that Erdogan's party, known as Justice and Development, AKP in Turkish, is a Muslim Brotherhood light. You know, because in Turkey, Islam is light, everything is light, and therefore even the political Islam version of that movement is light. And so I think Erdogan feels affinity for the Brotherhood in the region. He wanted the Brotherhood to succeed in Egypt, which is a hegemonic country in the Arab world, in the sense that Egypt does not invent trends, but if it adopts those trends, it makes them hegemonic because of the fact that, you know, Egyptians constitute more than a third of Arab population or Arab-speaking population, and because of the influence of their media and TV, they are able to shape and broadcast trends. And Erdogan thought that supporting Egypt and helping Morsi come to power and stay in power would allow Turkey to become an influential nation in the region. That also did not work out in the way Erdogan thought it would. The Brotherhood was ousted from power almost as soon as it rose to power. And the Brotherhood's opponents regionally, Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates, became Erdogan's regional nemesis, because UAE and Saudis consider the Brotherhood not only the greatest regional threat, but also the greatest domestic threat. So suddenly Turkey went from having all friends to having almost no friends in the Middle East. And its policy of supporting rebels trying to oust the Assad regime also put it at odds with Iran's allies and proxies in the region, from the Iraqi government to Hezbollah. So if you go through the list of Middle Eastern countries today, as opposed to 10 years ago when Turkey's economy was booming and Erdogan was visiting regional capitals and signing treaties and agreements with all different leaders, it's almost the opposite. He's not welcome anywhere. I have gone through a list of countries to which Turkey sent COVID-related assistance recently. There's not a single Middle Eastern nation there except for Libya, where Turkey's fighting a proxy war, in which I'll explain in a minute. But Turkey's assistance mostly went to Southern European, Balkan, and NATO member countries. So it shows that maybe Erdogan did try to call and say, hey, can I offer you assistance? And maybe the Saudis, Emiratis, and others said, no, thank you. I'm only hypothesizing, but it gives you a sense
of... Maybe they didn't want it, or they didn't think they needed it, yeah.
Probably. I mean, so there's a chapter in my recent book, Erdogan's Empire, Turkey and the Politics of the Middle East, in which I kind of summarize this, everything I've told you about how Turkey ended up being completely isolated. There is Erdogan's swearing in ceremony. He has just changed Turkey's constitution, made himself executive style president. He has accumulated more power than any Turkish leader has since Turkey became a multi-party democracy in 1950. He's about to take office as head of state, head of government, head of ruling party, head of police, which is a national force, head of the military as commander in chief. In other words, he's about to become the first sultan of Turkey's Second Republic. And guess who is there from the Middle East to say, you've done well, congratulations, Mr. President? Only the Emir of Qatar. So that means Turkey really has only one friend in the Middle East today in terms of states. And I think it's very different than what Erdogan thought would end up.
So now you already made that comment in passing. That's the question of Russia, right? You referred to it as Turkey's nemesis, which kind of comes across the opposite of a lot of people who reads Turkey kind of moving away from the West towards Russia, and Putin and Erdogan are becoming enjoying some sort of bromance, and you know, there's a closer relationship and two strong leaders. But from your vocabulary and how you have, you know, narrated what has happened last 4 or 5 years, especially since 2011-12, what you are actually hinting is that Russia and Turkish relations are not really necessarily an alliance as we understand it, or coming together. It's based on a necessity, perhaps the need to engage in Syria, a powerful bear on their north that they might get energy from, and the question of Black Sea, question of that. But they're also in competition with each other. They're also fighting a proxy war.
Absolutely. I would say it's not an alliance. I think analysis that says Turkey and Russia are allies is basically misguided and sometimes hit jobs on Erdogan. I think the best way to describe Turkish-Russian relationship is that it grew out of the complexity of the war in Syria, in which Turkey, after 2013, when Obama decided not to back the rebels and stop supporting the rebels, which Turkey hoped would overthrow the Assad regime, Turkey was left on its own. I think from 2013 to 2015 was quite a historic period in Turkish-Russian ties. By my count, as I've written in Erdogan's Empire, the Turks and the Russians fought 17 major wars between the time the Russians started pushing south towards the Black Sea, Turkish domains, Ottoman domains, Catherine the Great's era, until the collapse of the Russian Empire in 1917 with the Bolshevik Revolution. Guess who started all these 17 wars? The Russians. And guess who won them overall? Again, the Russians. So to me, in Syria in 2013, it looked like the 18th Turkish-Russian war was about to start. And you don't have to have a crystal ball to guess who would be the winner. And that feared scenario almost came true in 2015 when Turkey shut down a Russian plane that had violated its airspace from Syria. Putin slapped massive economic sanctions on Turkey. He banned tourism. Remember, Russians are number one tourists in terms of arrivals to Turkey. Yeah. He also threatened to shoot down any Turkish auxiliaries or Turkish troops inside Syria. So that almost meant the end of Turkey's campaign to oust Assad regime. And it looked like the 18th war was about to start. But then something really important happened in terms of Turkish politics, the failed coup plot against Erdogan. I think that changed Putin's calculus against Turkey completely. The coup plot was a nefarious attempt. It was carried out by part of the military against other rest of the military and against Erdogan. It left Erdogan completely traumatized. Now remember, Turkish capital Ankara came under attack militarily the last time before the coup, in 1402, when armies of Tamerlane occupied and the coup plotters bombed the capital. So you can just imagine how traumatic this is for Turkey's population, including those that are not Erdogan's supporters. I think Turkey's allies in NATO were really not quick to come to Turkey's assistance. UK is an exception, which is why I think Turkish-UK relations are much better than Turkish ties to other NATO allies, broadly speaking. Again, exceptions are there. I think Turkey's ties to Spain and Italy are quite solid. Those countries share Mediterranean concerns and security and what else. But broadly speaking, I think the United States and other allies were late to come to Turkey's assistance and to reach out with messages of empathy, not Vladimir Putin. He called Erdogan the day after the coup. He used the coup as an opening to reach out to Turkey. He calibrated Russian policy towards Turkey, almost made an historic shift. So I say that from Catherine the Great to Putin the Great, Russia was the nemesis that bullied Turkey. Starting with the morning of the coup plot, Russia went from being the nemesis that bullies Turkey to being the nemesis, still the nemesis, which now courts Turkey. Putin reached out. Erdogan invited Erdogan. Erdogan's first visit after the coup overseas was to St. Petersburg. Not to London, not to Brussels, not to Berlin, not to Washington. St. Petersburg, the imperial capital of Turkey's nemesis, right? Not even Moscow. He was hosted at Tsarist era Konstantinovsky Palace. You can just imagine the messaging that Putin is providing. He's saying, I'm from the empire that bullied your country. I'm about to help you. So if I have to guess, when Putin first dangled the offer to sell Turkey S-400 Russian-made missile defense system, an issue that is potential to cause a major rupture between Turkey and US and its NATO allies, I would say it was probably at the Konstantinovsky Palace, because Putin realized after the coup that left alone, Erdogan needed allies, friends, and if Putin played that role, he could, of course, then use this strategy to peel Turkey away from its NATO allies. And that strategy has been working. Then in Syria, Putin started to offer Turkey what it wanted. Until that moment, the United States was working in Syria with a group called People's Protection Forces, YPG, to fight the Islamic State. Now, the YPG happens to be an offshoot of another Kurdish group called Kurdistan Workers Party, PKK. The PKK is a terror-designated entity by UK, US, and all NATO allies. So basically, US was working with the offshoot of a terrorist group to fight another terrorist group. Turkey never accepted this policy. It said, look, the PKK is our sworn enemy, but we'll turn our head the other way until you defeat ISIS. But even after ISIS was defeated, the US did not move away from this policy of working with the Kurdish group. And that's what Putin used as an opportunity. He started to let Turkey go in and take parts of that country of Syria from YPG. So where the United States is not listening to Turkey's PKK-related concerns, Russia is. So that makes Russia more favorable. And I think that's the role Putin has been playing ever since the failed coup attempt in 2016. It does not mean Turkey and Russia are allies. It's more an imposed relationship that Turkey found it's useful to it after the coup plot. but it doesn't mean they're allies. Turkey and Russia differ on so many issues. Cyprus, Nagorno-Karabakh, Crimea, Ukraine, Libya, where they're actually locked in a proxy war. Russians are supporting General Haftar. Turkey is supporting UN-recognized government in Tripoli. But in Syria, I would say they are in arrangements of ad hoc deals and deconflicting mechanisms. It's not perfect. It often blows up, as it did in Idlib a few months ago, where a Russian-backed Russian military targeted Turkish troops. It created a major crisis in the relationship. So I would say Turkey and Russia are nowhere near allies. I think they have many differences, including in Syria. And I think that's where the U.S. has an opening. We've seen some positive news lately, perhaps related to Turkey's thinking that it might need to go to IMF for COVID-related assistance, but also for broader assistance, because Turkish economy has not been doing very well since 2018, and the U.S. has the golden vote in the IMF, and I think you have that issue. You also have the issue that during the Idlib crisis, when Russia targeted Turkish troops, U.S. provided Turkey with military and political support, which is, I think, the reason why Putin allowed Turkey to pummel Assad regime forces through a masterfully executed drone campaign. So I think Turkey now appreciates its relationship with the U.S. a bit more than it did a few years ago. So it's trying to come back around. And I've seen news reports that this S-400 purchase that Turkey was made, a deal that was probably first discussed after the coup attempt against Erdogan at the Konstantinovsky Palace, Turkey is now trying to kind of come away from that. It's saying, well, we bought the systems, but we're not going to turn them on. And if they don't turn them on, that might allow President Trump and the Congress a leeway to avoid slapping hard sanctions. And it might also prevent us from seeing a complete rupture in Turkish-US, Turkish-UK, and Turkish-NATO ties.
Sonia, it's amazing because when you were trying to untangle the question of Turkish-Russian relations, you inevitably included U.S. policies and performance into this conversation, because
absolutely,
it's a great example of how what Putin is great at, or Russia is great at, is exploiting the weaknesses actually that is already there and wants Turkey in NATO rather than out of NATO, because that's a great fault line it can play with. And U.S. lack of interest on an overall Syria policy or a much broader proactive Turkey policy has kind of brought us into this vulnerability where Russia could play the vulnerabilities of Turkey, and Turkey cannot give up on U.S. as much as it cannot give up on Russia. So it's kind of stuck between these two powers. But the question which I want to then move on to, Sonia, is the question of Eastern Mediterranean, right? Obviously, Cyprus matters a lot for the UK. We are a stakeholder. We have sovereign territories and bases. We have a historic presence. We've been part of the peace talks between the two sides of the island, as well as Greece and Turkey. But for the last year and two, we have seen an escalation over the island again, and peace processes have failed. The UN is still trying to pick up another one, but those high-level talks never really bore the fruit. I mean, it really doesn't cause a breakthrough. But it seems like the alignment of Israel with Egypt, with Greece, and with Cyprus and Russian comeback, the Russian investment in the port of Tartus in Syria, $550 million to be invested there for a mega Russian naval base. It looks like Turkey is isolated in Eastern Mediterranean, and it also at the same time is increasing the temperature over the question of energy resources. And there have been some tensions between Greece and Turkey lately too. Are we not paying enough attention to the possibility of an escalation over Cyprus or Eastern Med at this context? Or are we better off just ignoring the status quo and just maintaining?
No, I think we're going towards escalation in Libya. That might also involve unfortunate dogfights or, you know, military skirmishes in the Eastern Med. I don't want to see any of that, but it's plausible. So, and I also agree with your view that, you know, Russia is masterful in using regional dynamics to divide and create discord within NATO alliance. For instance, I think a lot of us believe that, you know, the Cold War is over and the West won it. I think the Putin view of the Cold War is that, yeah, the West won the first half of the Cold War. And then there was a break, starting with the rise of Putin in 1999. I think maybe Putin believes that Russia is playing the second half of the Cold War football game, and they're winning it. They have made major wins, and one major win is dividing NATO's second largest military, that of Turkey, against the rest of the alliance and against its largest military, that of the United States. The whole S-400 offer, which is was about to cause a complete rupture in Turkish-US ties, kick Turkey out of NATO defense planning, of course, was, I think, one way where Putin thought that he could divide Turkey against US, and it's worked. But I wouldn't say it's a done deal because there's so many differences between the two countries, Turkey and Russia, beyond Syria. Even in Syria, there are differences that we discussed. And the big issue, I think, is Libya. Because in Libya, Putin is supporting the force of General Haftar, who are also backed by UAE and Egypt. And as I said earlier, UAE and Egypt are Turkey's two regional nemesis. They want to undermine Turkish policies everywhere. UAE, for example, recently supposedly offered assistance to Assad regime so he would break the ceasefire with Turkey, according to media reports. We don't know if it's true or not. But there's so many areas, I think, if there's an anti-Turkish initiative in the Middle East, usually if you flip a stone, the Emiratis are under it. So they're also there in Libya. They're supporting General Haftar, who some people who are Libya analysts have described to me as someone who's sort of cut from the same cloth as Saddam Hussein was. Definitely not a nice guy. And there, Turkey happens to be supporting the UN-backed government in Tripoli. But there, I think, again, Erdogan's policies have left Turkey more isolated than it should be in this cause of supporting the UN-backed government. Because Turkish ties with Israel, which were excellent before the rise of Erdogan to power, have come undone under him. So Israel now doesn't necessarily like to see Erdogan thrive in the region. Egyptians oppose him. Turkey has old discord with Greek Cypriots and Greeks. So when you put them together, I think Turkey sees Libya now very strategically because it lies across the Eastern Mediterranean. And Turkey's other East Mediterranean neighbors, Greek Cypriots, Greeks, Israelis, and Egyptians are coming together in an axis as Turkey sees it. And not a day goes by before these countries sign another treaty to launch another initiative, security or natural gas related for cooperation, always excluding Turkey. So to overcome this block or axis of four countries isolating it, Turkey has decided to be more actively engaged in Libya because it also signed a treaty with the Tripoli government, which it's supporting, which makes Turkey and Libya maritime neighbors. So as Turkey sees it, if Turkey and Libya are connected, and if Tripoli government wins the war in Libya, that means Turkey can break this axis of Greek Cypriots, Greeks, Israelis, Egyptians that is isolating it in the Eastern Med. And I think that's why Turkey cannot afford to lose in Libya. I would say Turkey has lost in Syria, lost in the sense that it's not going to be able to oust Assad. I mean, it may have a foot at the table.
Give up on it a long time.
Yeah, at the end of the day, if there's a peace conference, Turkey will be invited to it because it controls territory. But if its goal was to oust Assad, it has lost it for it. In Libya, it could still win. Win means not letting Tripoli fall, supporting it so that the Turkish-Libyan maritime neighborhood concept stays alive. Yeah. There are other issues at stake in Libya. Turkey has Gaddafi-era debt still not collected. Yeah. If Haftar wins that war, there'll be two things he'll do. Number one, he's going to tell Turkey, forget that money. Number two, he's going to rip up that treaty that Tripoli signed with Ankara that made Turkey and Libya maritime neighbors. So I think that's a real escalation for Turkey. And unlike Syria, which is next door, where Turkey has taken down its cross-border operations because it's afraid of a contagion effect of COVID-19 virus, Libya, which is right across the water, Turkey doesn't have these concerns. On top of it, Emiratis and Saudis are escalating, especially Emiratis, their support to Haftar, despite a UN arms embargo. So I think, unfortunately, we'll only see more escalation in Libya because the stakes are quite high there.
And so now one final question from me, and that's the question of the 100th anniversary of the Turkish Republic, right? So it's 2023, and clearly President Erdogan has focused on that grand vision, Turkey 2.0, the one that redesigns the structures of governance. It shifted from prime ministry and parliament to a much stronger presidential system. I mean, everybody wrote articles about, is Turkey becoming Iran or etc., but actually Turkey became more a bit like China in its terms of its governance, a long-term president, a very strong single party rule and different committees. So the Turkey in its 100th anniversary, what is the vision that drives Erdogan government from now on? And what is it that we'd like to see in 2023?
I think Erdogan's vision was that he would accumulate political power and then shape Turkey in his own image, which is sort of the opposite of what Ataturk did. But Erdogan, ironically, is using the same methods that Mustafa Kemal Ataturk, the founder of Turkey, used. Ataturk was a Jacobin leader who came of military background. He didn't have to worry about democratic legitimacy. He was Turkey's first president and founder. And then he used his own image to shape Turkey. He used state resources, public policy, all of which he controlled, to shape Turkey in his own image as a secular Western European republic. I think Erdogan is doing the opposite. as I explained in my previous book, A New Sultan, in the sense that Erdogan is using state resources, public and education policy to shape Turkey in his own image. But this is the image that's almost opposite of what Ataturk stood for. Erdogan's image is that Turkey should be socially conservative, geographically Middle Eastern, primarily, and politically Islamist. That hasn't really worked. I mean, he has a base that loves him. As I said, he has a bright side, delivered phenomenal growth until recently. He lifted many people out of poverty. Turks live better off today than they did before Erdogan by any indicator. Even taking into account economic crisis, things look good. He has an excellently well-functioning healthcare system, for instance, which is, I think, why its mortality rates in terms of COVID risk is not so high compared to some other countries. But Erdogan also has a dark side. He is a nativist populist leader. He has brutalized, demonized, cracked down on demographics unlikely to vote for him. When you add them up, these constituencies include liberals, leftists, social democrats, Kurdish nationalists, Alevis. Alevis are liberal Muslims. They are to Islam what the Unitarian Church is to Christianity. They're about 10-15% of Turkey. And when you add these groups up that Erdogan has brutalized, you get nearly half of Turkey. So he has a half that loves him and adores him, and he has a half that loathes him. And increasingly, there is no space in the middle. Mm-hmm. And unlike Ataturk, who had a no democratic mandate to worry about, Erdogan does have a democratic mandate to worry about. He has elections. And I think Turkey's democracy is quite resilient. Mm-hmm. You know, oftentimes people compare Turkey to Russia, connects nicely to our other conversation on Putin and China. I say no. Yeah. What happened in Turkey last year, Erdogan's party, AKP, losing local elections for mayor in Istanbul, Ankara, and all big cities pretty much, could never happen in Russia or China because you would never have elections like that. Mm-hmm. But it could happen, what happened in Turkey, it could happen in Hungary and Poland, where indeed other nativist populist autocratic leaders, Orban and Kaczynski's party, have lost those countries' capitals, Budapest and Warsaw, to their opposition. So I think we have seen a serious demise of democracy under Erdogan, but we're also seeing its resilience and comeback. Mm-hmm. You know what? I think after nearly 20 years of Erdogan rule, his message that he's going to fix the problems and he can blame problems on Turkey's previous leaders doesn't sell anymore. Mm-hmm. Because after nearly two decades, people are saying, well, you can't blame problems on 20th century leaders anymore. You've been running Turkey for longer than anybody else has. Since 1923, since it was established. And they're also saying, why aren't you fixing these problems? So I think his message is no more fresh. He no more controls the narrative. There was a time, whether you liked Erdogan or not, he represented change in Turkey. Not anymore. I think it's now these opposition leaders from different mayors of different cities who were elected last year who represented change. They have presented all initiatives, popular initiatives to fight COVID pandemic. Erdogan's palace adopted these initiatives afterwards. He's not looking like a problem solver anymore because he doesn't control the narrative and he doesn't look like the face of change. So I would say, yes, Erdogan might still be president in 2023, but he will have an ever-shrinking base, especially because economic growth is out. It's the primary reason why his party lost Istanbul and other cities' elections last year. So I don't think his vision of becoming a leader who was popularly loved and whose vision is embraced by majority of Turkey is going to be necessarily supported by 2023.
Sonar, thank you so much. This has been such a rich conversation. We have pretty much covered everywhere we could. I mean, also we could have discussed a lot of other stuff relating to Turkey and its geography and its foreign policy. But I think one of the key points that you made at the start of this conversation was that, yes, Turkey might not necessarily be the easiest partner to engage with, but it's a great game spoiler. It's one country that we need to understand, work with, and align with when it's necessary, and find ways to cooperate on all those issues. And when we don't, others fill in the gap. That creates a lot more larger questions and headaches for NATO and our alliance. Sonar, thank you so much for your
time. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And I agree that if NATO doesn't engage Turkey, Russia comes in. And I know we had agreed this would be a foreign policy discussion. So I'm sorry that I had to sneak in some domestic angle as well, because I love studying Turkey.
By all means. And thanks to everybody who watched this video.
Thanks so much for hosting me, Zia. Have a great day.